From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen about their thriller Eastern Promises. It comes out on DVD next week. Mortensen plays the menacing driver for a Russian crime family in London, a family involved in drugs, sex trafficking, and murder. Also, we remember the Grammy-winning record producer Joel Dorn, who died this week at age 65. He worked with jazz greats Max Roach and Herbie Mann, and also produced many pop artists, including Roberta Flack, Bette Midler, and the Allman Brothers. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some recommendations for jazz lovers on your gift list, and David Edelstein will tell you what's good in theaters this holiday season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. After teaming up on the film A History of Violence, director David Cronenberg and actor Viggo Mortensen made another film together called Eastern Promises. This time, Mortensen has been nominated as Best Actor in a Drama by the Screen Actors Guild, and the film has gotten 3 Golden Globe nominations, including Best Movie Drama and another nomination for Mortensen. Also, Eastern Promises is about to be released on DVD. Today on Fresh Air, we hear from both David Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen in a joint interview with Terry from earlier this year. Cronenberg also made Scanners, The Fly, Videodrome, and Dead Ringers. Mortensen co-starred in the Lord of the Rings films, A Walk on the Moon, and A Perfect Murder. Eastern Promises is a thriller set in London. A pregnant teenage girl collapses in a pharmacy and is rushed to the hospital, where she dies in childbirth. The nurse midwife takes a special interest in the orphaned infant. She takes the mother's diary, which is in Russian, and tries to get it translated so she can track down the baby's extended family. The diary leads her to a Russian restaurant she doesn't realize is owned by the head of a Russian crime family. She also doesn't realize why the Russian mob boss is interested in the diary. He wants to make sure it doesn't implicate him in any crimes. After the midwife's first visit to the restaurant, she's driven home by the family's driver, a menacing-looking character who also does a lot of the family's dirty work. The midwife is played by Naomi Watts, the driver by Viggo Mortensen.
Have you ever met a girl called Tatiana?
I met a lot of girls called Tatiana.
She was pregnant.
Ah, in that case, no, I never heard of her.
She died on my shift.
I thought you did birth.
Sometimes birth and death go together. She came in with needle punches all over both arms. Probably a prostitute, the age of 14. Do you think Semyon's son knew her?
I'm a driver. I go left, I go right, I go straight ahead, that's it.
I'll take the next right.
David Cronenberg, Viggo Mortensen, welcome to Fresh Air. David, would you describe the Russian criminal organization that you portray in the movie?
It's a many-headed hydra, you know. It's very interesting. I mean, one of the books that I read when I was doing research for this movie was called Violent Entrepreneurs, and it was about the role of criminality in the rise of current Russian capitalism. And in a way, since the fall of the Soviet Union, what we have seen is, if you're looking at it just as a social scientist, it's very interesting because you're seeing the rawest, most virulent form of capitalism possible as it arises out of Russia. And most of the oligarchs and that we have heard about have definitely had criminal past. I mean, there's almost no other way to start your life as a Russian capitalist without dealing with criminals if in fact you aren't one yourself. So that, to me, that was the underpinning for me. That is kind of, they're kind of ardent capitalists really first, and then they also have this whole past that goes beyond communism back to the Tsarist days and the days of Russian prisons in which there was a bond formed that sort of floated outside of society. It was a brotherhood of thieves, the Vory ve Zakoni, which means thieves in law, literally. It's not really like the mafia because at that time it had nothing to do with businesses and having a facade of respectability. You were a thief, and your thievery was written on your body in tattoos. I mean, it was obvious to anybody who knew how to read your body like a book, who you were, where you were, what your sexual orientation was, how many crimes you committed, what prisons you had been in, how much time you did there. So that's the sort of underpinning of this group, which we have to understand is a displaced group. This is the Russian mob in London. So it's not only is it a strange form of Russian criminality, but it's a kind of an exported kind that's growing in a very specific way in a different soil. It's not in the black earth of Russia. It's now in the green earth of England.
Viggo Mortensen, you play a member of this Russian crime organization, a branch that is in London, a branch of emigres there. And you are covered in tattoos. And as David Cronenberg explained, each of those tattoos is supposed to say something about your past, about who you are. You know, people, actors always talk about how the clothing they wear helps them get into character. What did having all those tattoos on your body do for you?
Well, it was helpful, and it does say a lot. And even if you don't know what David was talking about, even if you're not a Russian criminal or an expert in Russian criminal tattoos, old school tattoos, you do feel that there's something, and there is symbolically something about, apart from it being either off-putting or, well, certainly remarkable that you see this person covered and that their fingers have tattoos and everything else. They're part of the thieves' code. And my body is, you know, sort of my calling card,
my passport.
Yeah.
I don't want to give away too much of the film, but there's one scene I just absolutely have to talk with you about, and anyone who sees this movie will want to hear what you have to say about this scene. There's an incredible scene in a steam bath where Viggo Mortensen, your character, is asked there for a meeting, and when the meeting is over, you're sitting there alone, naked, except you're completely covered in these tattoos that we've been talking about, these tattoos that have imprinted your life story on your body. Then, for reasons I won't explain, two fully clothed thugs come into the steam bath and begin to try to kill you with their fists and with knives, and you're there completely naked in this fight scene, covered with the tattoos. Your blood mixes with the ink of the tattoos. It's an incredible scene in so many ways. And I guess David Cronenberg, let me start with you here. What are some of the things that you wanted from this scene? I mean, I've never seen anything like it before.
Mm. Well, I guess it ends up being our shower scene from Psycho, you know? I mean, there, weirdly enough, I think some of the dynamics are the same. That is to say, how vulnerable can you ever be? And when you're wet and naked, that seems to, and people are coming at you with knives, that seems to be kind of the bottom line for vulnerability. Of course, it's all set up on many levels in the movie. It's not just dropped in sort of gratuitously. But the other thing, too, is that my approach to movies, and in particularly this movie, is that it's that people come to a movie to live another life. You know, they come there to be someone else, to inhabit someone else, and I take that to be physically as well. So I want the audience to be Viggo in this scene, to be Nikolai. And then that means that the way I shoot it, I want it to be experienced fully and physically. And therefore, I don't use sort of the Bourne movie type impressionistic quick cutting, which is certainly a valid approach to action and has its own effect. But I want the audience to see everything and feel everything as it really happens, or as close as you can get making a movie. So when the stunt coordinator who was helping the actors work out the action talks to me, I want to see everything. I want it all to make physiological sense. I want it to be logical. I want it to be hard work. I don't want to skip over anything. No jump cutting, no slow motion. I want it to feel real, absolutely real. Of course, everybody says, well, you know, you've got a star who's doing a scene naked and it's not a sex scene. I mean, this is unusual. But I say, well, you know, it was a very quick discussion. We were working out the choreography and Viggo said, well, you know, it's obvious I have to do this naked. And I said, yeah, okay. And that was pretty much it, you know, for that discussion.
Mm-hmm. It's not just, it's not a scene where it's like, ooh, it's Viggo Mortensen nude. It's a scene where it's like, here is this man facing his mortality naked in the world. And this scene just gives such a powerful sense of the human body's resilience and vulnerability, and of this one man's resilience and vulnerability. And it's just, I don't know, it also just seems to me as how, like, you enter the world and you come out of the world, you know, naked. And that's, no matter what kind of stuff you put on, you are finally naked. And I just think it's a wonderful scene. At the same time, you had to deal with all the practicalities of shooting an actor naked and making sure that everything was exposed in the way you wanted it to be exposed, and not to call...
You're not talking about film exposure, are you?
No, but right? I mean...
I didn't
want to overemphasize, like, the genital part of the... You wanted to be there, but not overemphasize.
The truth is that I didn't think about those things when I was shooting it. I mean, that was the freedom that I had with Vigo, you know? I mean, it would have been silly for him to have a towel wrapped around him that never moved in a scene like that.
Right.
And it would have been very restrictive for me if I had to not show anything from sort of belly button to knees or something like that. So I actually didn't worry about how we were shooting it. That was the freedom that I had, whether things were flattering, not flattering, attractive, not attractive. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like the difference between shooting with an actor who is constantly worried about how he looks, does he look good, does his skin look good, and so on, you know, and you have to light him that way, and that takes a terrible toll on the mood of a movie, for example, if you can't light it dramatically because the actor's wrinkles show, for example. And this was a sort of an equivalent of that. It could have been, but I actually totally didn't worry about it. I shot it the way I would have shot it if he had been wearing clothes.
Mm-hmm. Viggo Mortensen, did you think about that at all?
No, I mean, I was aware of the fact, and we discussed that in passing when we were working out the fact, you know, we're also friends, and he's courteous, and he's just being practical. So what I'm thinking, how long it's going to take to shoot, and he shot it in about half the time anybody would. I don't think if you had twice the budget, you would have shot it differently.
No, that's right. We had lots of time.
And most directors, even not using slow motion and everything else, with the angles and having to use three rooms and flying around all over the place, they would have probably taken a good week to do it. He did it in 2 days, which I was glad of that because, you know, I did get a little banged up for obvious reasons. I couldn't have pads and things on my knees and elbows and back and whatnot. And the quicker it was over in a way, the better. And the quicker they moved along in the day, the better. Because after they'd say cut, you know, I would become a little self-conscious at times, but not so much. I mean, I played it the same way he shot it, as if I had clothes. It was just a scene about a particular thing. And I did think towards the end, when I started to accumulate a certain amount of bruises, that they did have to airbrush to cover.
Well, they did, actually.
I thought it was karmic retribution for what happened to Maria Bello on the wooden stairs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. She was the one who got bruised there, and he got bruised here. Yeah,
they're referring, by the way, for our listeners who don't know, to a very kind of rough sex scene in History of Violence, which is the previous film that David Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen collaborated on.
Maria Foneman wanted to be one of the killers in that scene of Viggo,
really,
but I couldn't make it work.
The one who kicks me.
Viggo Mortensen and David Cronenberg speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with David Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen, the director and star of Eastern Promises. But first, here's another clip from the movie, again featuring Mortensen and Naomi Watts. She's just discovered that he isn't just a driver for the Russian mob, but may, in fact, be a full-blown member.
She was 14! Read the diary! She was 14 when he raped her. You bastards murdered her.
Успокойся. Anger is very dangerous. Makes people do stupid things. Please, forget any of this ever happened. You're in very wrong place, Anna Ivanovna. You belong in there, with nice people. Stay away from people like me.
Viggo Mortensen, you not only had to learn a Russian accent for the movie, you have to speak with a really commanding presence and sometimes a very menacing voice, which is totally unlike how you're speaking now. You sound very soft-spoken, completely non-threatening, the way you're speaking now. Would you talk a little bit about what you did vocally, both in terms of the accent, but also in terms of the menace that your voice sometimes assumes?
Well, there's one thing that I've noticed or that has been brought to my attention, and it makes sense to me. You know, people have said I speak Spanish because I was raised in until I was 11, mostly in a Spanish-speaking country in Argentina. So I speak Spanish like I do English. And also because of my family and living there, I speak Danish. But when I speak Spanish, for example, people have said to me, you sound different, you seem, not just the words, but the tone and your body language is different. And it's something that the language informs you, the sounds you make and the ideas behind them, the sort of concepts that are particular to a culture and a language, change the way you present yourself even without you realizing it. And with Russian, there are sounds in that language that helped me and that did a lot of the work for me.
What were some of the sounds within the Russian accented English you had to speak that helped you get the power that you needed for the role?
Well, I wasn't conscious of them, and they come under that thing of, well, I don't want to analyze, I don't want
sure,
to kill
yeah,
something.
Okay,
I just felt different. It was like you talked about earlier, you know, when the actor first tries on his wardrobe or his costume and starts to get used to it, and, you know, like I like to, you know, can I borrow the watch and can I borrow the shoes and break them in and make them my own so I feel comfortable? It helps you. It does a lot of the work for you. And the language in this case really helped. There are, you know, I had the advantage from speaking some Latin language that certain R sounds or J, hard J sounds, I could get to them easier. But there are some vowel sounds or combinations of sounds that are particular to Russian. And also Ukrainian, which I speak a little bit of in the movie, but although you wouldn't know it, there's a transition into Ukrainian briefly that a Russian would know, or a Ukrainian. But those sounds were a little harder to get, you know, the ones that are very specific. But we eventually got there. It was the effort of getting there that also, I just found myself moving differently and seeming different when I was concentrating on getting those sounds right. I can't explain it exactly, and I don't know that I'd want to know, break it down completely. I mean, I just know that it made things different, and it was as important to me as the clothing, as the car that I had to drive in my occupation as chauffeur for these underworld types.
David Cronenberg, Viggo Mortensen was best known for his roles in The Lord of the Rings, and is still probably best known for that. But you saw, I think, a different quality in him. And I'm wondering, why did you want to start working with him? I think what we see of him in A History of Violence and in your new film, Eastern Promises, is just kind of different than what we're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And what did you see in him, and how did you notice it? How did you know you wanted to work with him?
Well, I just thought he was really quite interesting visually and in presence, and obviously had a good ear for languages, a musical ear. It didn't surprise me to finally realize that he spoke fluent Spanish and Danish and pretty good French and some Italian, some German maybe. And also, for both movies, more for this one, but even for History of Violence, accent, language was a key thing.
Mm-hmm.
In a weird way, Eastern Promises is about language. And to a lesser extent, but still important, History of Violence was too. Now, Viggo's really doing two accents in History of Violence, because the sort of Indiana accent is not his natural accent, and it's very subtle. And then there's the Philly accent that comes later that is, you know, also extremely subtle, but really important. So and then once we had worked together, I realized that he wasn't just good, he was great, I have to say. And so then, of course, he was a marked man for me because now I want him to be in every movie that I do. When I was reading Eastern Promises and reading the role of Nikolai, it reminded me that Viggo had always seemed to me to have a Slavic element to his looks, to his face, to his cheekbones. And I don't know whether that's Danish and some great-grandmother was messing around with Russians, or I don't know. You never know. But and I had thought that when we were shooting History, because a director has a relationship with an actor that's really quite bizarre and not much known, which continues beyond the actor's actual physical presence. You know, I'm in the editing room and I'm obsessively looking at my actors' faces, looking for the best take, the most subtle intonations of their voice. And sometimes I'm even taking sounds from one take and putting them in the mouth of another take. So you become incredibly sensitized to an actor's face and physical presence and voice. And so all of that I had gone through with Viggo in History of Violence really made me feel that he was absolutely the perfect guy for Nikolai.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Terry. It's a really nice conversation.
David Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen speaking to Terry Gross. Their latest film together, Eastern Promises, is about to be released on DVD. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what? Come on, baby.
Coming up, we remember record producer Joel Dorn, who died this week at age 65. He produced this album for Les McCann and Eddie Harris. Dorn called it the luckiest record of his career. Also, David Edelstein on Movies for the Winter Break, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has gift ideas for jazz fans.
Slaughterhouses are killing hogs. Twisted children are killing frogs. Poor dumb rednecks rolling logs. Tired old ladies kissing dogs. I hate the human love of that stinking mud.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. For his holiday gift suggestions for jazz fans this year, critic Kevin Whitehead recommends a couple of smaller CD box sets by veteran bebop musicians and some historical jazz on DVD. Thank you.
drummer Roy Haynes' 1961 with Stan Getz and strings. For six decades, Haynes has been a drummer of choice for jazz stars like Lester Young, Charlie Parker, Sarah Vaughan, Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane, and Pat Metheny. All of them appear on A Life and Time, The Roy Haynes Story, a new anthology spread over three CDs and a DVD. It's less a showcase for aggressive drumming than a reminder of how much great and good music Haynes contributed to as a team player between 1949 and 2006. That makes this the rare drummer's retrospective that may leave you wishing for more drum solos. He's that tasteful and creative. Roy Haynes did get a bit waylaid in the 1970s, unsure where to turn next. Trading in bebop's odd bass drum accents for disco's relentless thump proved not to be the answer. Happily, that phase didn't last, and Haynes went back to the bop bass music he still plays. The DVD includes a recent performance with his quartet, a vintage drum solo, and Haynes talking at length about his life and music. All in all, A Life and Time is a winner. So was another anthology devoted to a great veteran still going strong in his 80s, tenor saxophonist Von Freeman. But this set, two CDs and a DVD, starts in 1996 when Von was already 73. The best of Von Freeman on Premonition comes from the Chicago label that's made documenting this hometown hero a priority. There's plenty of bebop and blues, a couple of lovely unaccompanied tenor ballads, and fine support from pianists Richard Wyans and Jason Moran, drummer Jimmy Cobb, guitarist Mike Alamana, and others. The DVD includes a long public interview, worth it just for the 15 minutes Freeman spends talking about bandleader Sun Ra. There's also a hilarious verbal improvisation, Von making a few remarks in 2002 when a stretch of Chicago's East 75th Street was named for him. His comments include some pet licks and unexpected detours, kind of like his saxophone solos.
Because jazz music is not above anybody, but it does take some kind of brain to understand it. No, I don't mean to say it like that. It's that seems to be putting down somebody. But it does take a little musical intelligence. No, I don't mean to say that either. What I'm trying to say is that it takes a little caring about music that you might not understand. Thank you. I don't try to play over anyone's head. I don't try to say jazz is greater than any other music in the world, because I come up through all the music. I come up through ragtime, Dixieland, on the swing, on the bebop, on the free, on the avant-garde, and now nobody knows what I'm playing.
Thank you.
Chicagoans would throw themselves on a hand grenade for Von Freeman. With this set, the rest of the world can know why. Of straight jazz DVDs this season, the obvious gift choices are the second batch in the Jazz Icons series. These concert and studio performances from the 50s and 60s were filmed or taped for European television, which features way more jazz than American TV has since the 50s. There isn't a loser in the bunch. Guitarist Wes Montgomery bounces off the rhythms of Dutch drummer Han Benink on one disc, and John Coltrane mixes it up with fellow saxophonist Eric Dolphy and Stan Getz on another. There's singer Sarah Vaughan in her late 50s, early 60s prime, and Dexter Gordon, Dave Brubeck, and Charles Mingus, all in fine form. If I had to choose one, it'd be Duke Ellington's orchestra, caught on a very good night at Amsterdam's Concertgebouw in 1958. But any of these shows should make a jazz fan's eyes light up like some kind of festive, decorated tree.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Coming up, we hear an interview from our archives with record producer Joel Dorn, who died earlier this week. This is Fresh Air. Record producer Joel Dorn, a respected influential figure in both pop and jazz music, died this week of a heart attack. He was 65. Dorn worked at Atlantic Records for nearly 15 years. He produced Grammy-winning recordings by Bette Midler and Roberta Flack. In the jazz section of the company, he produced albums with Les McCann, Eddie Harris, Razan Roland Kirk, and Mose Allison. After leaving Atlantic Records, Dorn started a number of specialty labels which focused on live or reissued recordings. His Night label featured live club recordings like this one with Eddie Harris. Eddie Harris, recorded live in San Francisco in 1978. Joel Dorn's Night label featured recordings which were made when the musicians had no idea they were even being recorded. Tapes made by amateurs and club owners. Tapes never intended for commercial release. Terry spoke to Dorn after he launched the label. She asked him how he found some of the tapes.
I have a friend named Bernard Drayton, who is black. When he was young, which was the late 50s, early 60s, there were no black recording engineers in the studios in New York. There just weren't. But he wanted to become a recording engineer. So he bought his own little Radio Shack level remote equipment. I'm talking about a tape recorder, a microphone, a mixing board. Prevailed upon the jazz musicians in New York. He was one of those kids, you know, who was always backstage or trying to get in clubs or stuff. Prevailed upon the musicians that when they worked their gigs, not in Manhattan, not at Birdland or the Village Gate or those places, but when they worked out in the boroughs, Brooklyn, the Bronx, and these little tiny clubs, when they would get their material together for their recordings for the New York jazz labels, they let him record these gigs under the set of rules for it was you could never release it, and it was just, you know, basically it was give a brother a break, you know. They were letting him record these gigs so that he could learn how to become a recording engineer. And he did it with the understanding that he would never release them or play them for anybody else. Boom. It's 30 years later. I'm sitting in his office in November of 1986. And we had talked about these tapes off and on for years. And we had had a meeting about something else and casually said to him, I said, Bernie, maybe we should do something with those tapes of yours. Now it's 30 years later. Let me see if I can go get the clearances.
Did your friend Bernie Drayton record the Eddie Harris record?
No. We got those tapes from Eddie Harris, so we had some stuff from San Francisco, some stuff from Chicago. We called it A Tale of Two Cities, you know.
No, and the Eddie Harris record, one of the tracks, has him doing basically like an impersonation of Billie Holiday, but he's not singing, he's kind of doing it into his saxophone.
That particular cut was done in San Francisco at the Keystone Corner, and what he does is he does an impersonation of Billie Holiday through some kind of electronic thing that he does through the saxophone, so he evokes that Billie Holiday sound without actually ever saying words. It's vocalese. But the strings and the piano, he plays them too, and they're operated by foot controls. So he stands on stage alone with a saxophone. It looks like he's playing it, but he's singing into it. With his left foot, he controls the piano. With his right foot, he controls the string orchestra. And he just does it.
Who recorded the Ross and Roland Kirk sessions that you used?
Once again, that was done in San Francisco at Keystone Corner, but also in New Orleans and also in Paris. A variety of sources. We listened to 178 tapes to get, I think, 53 minutes of Rossan.
One of the things that Kirk used to always do at conferences was play three horns at one time, three saxophones at a time.
Right.
And you have an example of him doing that on the record. Why did you want to get an example of him doing that live?
Well, number one, it was kind of the thing that people spoke about. When you speak of Rossan Roland Kirk, they'll say, well, he was the blind guy who, and they'll always say, played three horns at once. That was, you know, his kind of his trademark. I remember the first time I saw it was here in Philadelphia at the Academy of Music in 1961. And I was watching backstage when he put those three horns in his mouth. First time I saw him, he was imitating the Ellington horn section. And it absolutely, watching him do it and looking out from backstage and seeing the audience react, it was like, well, we're on radio, so opening my mouth doesn't make any difference. But everybody, you know, was like gasping.
Cannonball Adderley on the record with him. There's a beautiful recording of Stars Fell on Alabama.
Yeah.
Tell me something about this recording and why you included it.
Well, I listened to 520 tapes to get the Les McCann record, 60 tapes to get the Eddie Harris record, 178 tapes to get the Rossan Roland Kirk record, two tapes to get the Cannonball Adderley. It just jumped out of the... It was just one of those nights where everything was right. We got those tapes from Las Vegas, a disc jockey who moved there from New York, who had done some live radio shows at the Half Note. I was always a big Cannonball Adderley fan. I was thrilled. And interestingly, that was a very rare period for Cannon. It was just before he became a big kind of like pop jazz artist, and it was just at the end of when he was a major commercial jazz and artistic jazz success, kind of on the cusp of careers. The interesting thing about Stars Fell in Alabama, if you listen to it, or an interesting thing to me is, that was done New Year's Eve in 1967, or New Year's Eve 68, whatever, however it goes, in New York, and musicians traditionally hate to play New Year's. It's the worst time in the world. Everybody's drunk, nobody cares, they're just out to scream and yell, you know, and get loaded. The audience is barely paying attention to them if you listen. There's a lot of noise. You hear all these conversations going on. And through all of this, on the worst night of the year for any musician, you just hear Cannon rise to this magnificent level. I thought that was a... He's recorded that song twice, and I heard him play it in person maybe a dozen times. He sounded like if Johnny Hodges and Bird had a son, it would have been Cannon then. And I thought it was a real touching performance.
Ask you, are any of the musicians getting angry at the people who recorded them without letting the musicians
Sometimes,
know what was happening?
I would say there are two instances. In the 4.5 years we've been doing it where two people got livid. At that point, we gave them the tapes, said, you know, sorry if you're bugged, they're yours, talk to you later.
Yeah.
Here's what I found. When I first went into this, one of the reasons I approached it with some kind of trepidation was people used to get livid when they found that they were recorded in an unauthorized manner. It's 30 years later. A lot of times that's the best work they ever did, or that period's never coming back again, or they, instead of getting angry, they say, man, I thought I'd never hear me playing with so-and-so, or that was a great period, you know. So it's different now. Is it all peaches and cream? Absolutely not. But I'd say 85-90% of the time people go, great, man, and love it.
Joel Dorn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks.
Joel Dorn speaking to Terry Gross in 1991. He died this week at age 65. Coming up, David Edelstein on movies playing over the holidays. This is Fresh Air. There's no shortage of movies in the theaters this holiday season. Our film critic, David Edelstein, has been frantically seeing them all and has a roundup of the movies playing now or about to open up.
How can anyone keep up with all the movies opening this time of year? I can't, and it's my day job. Between the popcorn flicks and the kiddie stuff and the art films that need to open before December 31st to qualify for the Oscars, it's madness, I tell you, madness. I've already praised on this program The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, The Savages, and No Country for Old Men. Let's take the rest from my least to most favorite. The Golden Compass is deadly. I Am Legend is a decent thriller with Will Smith as the last human in New York against bald, feral vampires. The best thing is seeing a metropolis depopulated, a lovely fantasy if you've been fighting holiday shopping crowds. Atonement has the Oscar buzz. It's a faithful adaptation of Ian McEwan's novel that crams in all the big themes, the shifts in perspective, and the final act of narrative rug-pulling that knocked me for a loop. Well, it did on the page. The movie is a more arm's-length experience. But as a working-class martyr, James McAvoy will certainly make millions of teenage girls and teenage girls at heart sob almost as hard as they did when a certain ocean liner went down. The Kite Runner is brisk and bland, but if you've read the novel, you know it has a great melodramatic hook. As a boy, the Afghan narrator stood by and did nothing when his little friend, the son of his father's servant, was raped by bullies. As a grown-up, he has a chance to redeem himself by returning to Kabul to rescue his friend's son from Taliban rapists. The link between totalitarianism and homosexual aggression is provocative, to say the least. The uplift comes in the closing scene, the camera soaring and swooping along with the kites. It's back to Kabul again in Charlie Wilson's War, based on George Crile's book about a congressman, played here by Tom Hanks, who got the funding for a covert CIA operation in Afghanistan. That helped the Afghans devastate the Soviet occupiers, which helped precipitate the fall of the Soviet Empire, which led, ironically, to Al-Qaeda getting its hands on a lot of American weapons. It's momentous stuff, told by writer Aaron Sorkin and director Mike Nichols in a lickety-split style that makes the history lesson go down easily. Philip Seymour Hoffman steals the show as the CIA guy who hates commies and his clueless bosses in equal measure.
Do you drink?
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, should we try? This scotch is going to release sarin gas when I open it.
I don't think so, but open it over there.
Not a guy like you getting to the agency.
What, you mean a street guy?
You ain't James Bond.
You ain't Thomas Jefferson, so let's call it even.
Deal.
Since there's no other reason I should be here, let's assume it's because I'm very good at this.
John C. Reilly plays the title character in Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, a broad satire of musician biopics like Walk the Line that proves A, the conventions of biopics really are lame, and B, you can get a lot of laughs out of basically one joke if your lead is John C. Reilly. He has a stronger singing voice than the stars of Sweeney Todd, Johnny Depp, and Helena Bonham Carter, but Tim Burton's film of Stephen Sondheim's masterpiece is spellbinding anyway. Most directors open up Broadway musicals, adding meaningless busyness to make them more cinematic, and they end up diluting them. Burton constricts the space and concentrates the melodrama. He finds the perfect balance between the funereal and the ferocious. He scales Sweeney Todd to his stars, almost fetishizing their ghoulishness with his close-ups, and oh, the blood. Against the black and gray monochromatic backdrop, it geysers out, phosphorescent. It's Burton's way of cackling, "You're a long way from Broadway, folks." Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood is even freakier. It's a psychodrama with the epic scale of an Old Testament parable. It wouldn't work without an actor as intense and magnificent as Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays Daniel Plainview, a monomaniacal oil man. Day-Lewis looms as large as the derricks that dominate the unruly Central California landscape. He wears a thick, curly mustache, and his face is long and straight, like a Balinese mask. His eyes are slits. They sparkle only when he trains them on his principal antagonist, a self-styled young preacher named Eli Sunday, played by Paul Dano, who sees through Plainview's ruse to buy the Sunday family farm to hunt quail.
The Lord has sent this man here, Eli. Yes, I believe he has. My offer to you is $3,700.
What is it that brought you here, sir?
The good Lord's guidance. Now, of course, within that, we're going to develop a lease. What's that?
What about our oil?
What about it?
We have oil here. That's worth something.
Oh, do you have someone who can drill for it? Do you think there's oil here?
I know there is.
Oh, it's very expensive to drill. To get it up and out of the ground. You ever tried that before?
How much is it?
costly.
Well, our oil sits right up on top of the ground.
I believe that's called seepage. Doesn't necessarily mean there's anything underneath.
What would you give us for it?
I don't know.
Something you don't know.
That's right.
That voice, it's like John Huston's. And Day-Lewis could be playing an up-and-coming Noah Cross, Huston's monstrous mogul in Chinatown. In There Will Be Blood, his lust for oil corrodes every family tie. The movie is transfixing, with an astounding classical score by Radiohead guitarist Johnny Greenwood that steeps you in bad karma. The showdown between Plainview and Eli had preview audiences hooting in derision. I think it's bonkers, but brilliant. The sick joke fate of a capitalist titan. Anderson has made a mad American classic.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hersfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans. On the web, at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the top 10 trends of 2007. John Powers joins us to talk about atheist chic, hip sentimentality, and the writer's strike. And I'll talk with Terry Gross about the best and worst in television this year. Join us for the next Fresh Air.